Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books in African Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Elisa Prosperetti. In Africa, when an elder dies, a library burns. We've all heard this phrase, or some version of it, but not all of us know who uttered it. Well, it was Amadou Ampateba, and the year was 1960, that famous year of Africa, when more than one dozen African countries, including Mali, Ba's homeland, gained independence. But with that statement, Ba was cautioning us to remember the fragility of what could be lost amid the rush for change in this new era of independence. By the end of his long life, Ba himself had become one of Africa's most famous elders, and to borrow his own phrase, one of its most expansive libraries. Today, we are speaking with Jean Gurani and Ralph Austin, who are here to discuss Ampateba's newly translated early memoirs, published in English under the title Amkulel, the Fula Boy. The book was originally published 30 years ago in French at the end of Ba's long life and was awarded the Grand Prix Littéraire d'Afrique Noire in 1991. Jean Gurani, who translated the memoir, is a professor of French and comparative literature at the University of South Carolina. Ralph Austin is professor emeritus of African history at the University of Chicago. Jean and Ralph, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So why don't we begin with you both introducing yourselves to us. Tell us how you became interested in Ampateba and his career, and in particular in this project. Jean, we should begin with you as the translator of this work.
Well, I think became enamored of Amadou Ampateba after I read Vingrin, like many people have read. It got me interested in the role of indigenous African interpreters. So I've always had a foot in translation as well as in critical literary studies. And I've translated two books previous to this. And so I got very interested in this figure of Vingrin and began trying to do research on the question of indigenous African interpreters, which brought me to the work of Ralph Austin, who has done a lot of work in this area and who had written about Amadou Ampateba. So while I was, thinking about trying to continue this work in the field of translation studies, I think somewhat like Ralph, decided to, go to the archives, l'Archive d'Outre-mer in Aix-en-Provence to see what I could find out about the indigenous African interpreters. And I was told, as I was mentioning earlier, that Professor Austin from the University of Chicago had already done that work, and therefore I wasn't going to get a whole lot of help from the staff at the time. But they did, kind of point me to the database. And when I did my research in the database, up comes again Amadou Ampateba. I ended up going to Senegal also to the IFAN and doing some research there. It wasn't easy. I did find some information, so this is how I I think part of what I wanted to do was to make a contribution to the field of Amadou Hampate Bass studies and also to translation studies by undertaking this translation. And I can talk more about it later, but I'll let Ralph have a little time.
Well, I came to this by a rather indirect route. When I was in college, I majored in something called history and literature. So I had some interest in literature and had done a few. I actually wrote about another memoir, but, you know, saw it presented as a novel, L'Enfant Noir, the dark child. But that's a very different kind of book. You asked possibly compare them in the question before, maybe we can get back to that. But in general, I was a specialist in former German colonies. I worked in Tanzania and in Cameroon. And I got involved in Cameroon a little bit in the study of an oral epic. So I published about that. But the way I got to Hampate Bass through, this is very much the sort of story he would tell, through an elder man named Henri Brunschvig, who was one of the pioneers of African history in France. And at one point he stayed at our house when he was here for some kind of conference. I spent a good deal of time with him and so on. As a gift appreciation, he sent me Van Grimp, the French version, hadn't been translated to English yet. So I got interested in there. And then I was asked by the research in African literature to write something about Amkulel. So I got into that. And at first I was kind of frightened up because I thought of Hampate Bass writing all these texts about religion and mysteries and, you know, his own sort of versions of Islam, which are not really as widely read as what he considered really just, I think, recordings of his dinner table conversations. I mean, I never met him, unfortunately, but one person I worked with, Louis Brenner, did know him fairly well and actually gave me some of his correspondence with a French, with Théodore Monod, which was an important figure in his life. And he was a great raconteur. You can get that from all kinds of accounts of him. I mean, he knew a lot of people and they wrote about him. They were very impressed. And so this, he didn't publish, by the time he published these memoirs, he was quite old, even though they're about his youth. And if you think of them as coming of this, Amkulel is a coming of age story, a Bildungsroman. Usually those are written when as a first novel, which is true of The Dark Child, for instance. But in his case, it was something he sort of reflected on at old age when he was mostly living in Paris and not, or to some extent at Abidjan, but not really so active in research anymore. The further volumes of this book, there are three volumes. One that has been published, and I hope Jean is going to work on it in the future, about his career in the Huit Mont, it's called Huit Mont Commandant, it's about his career as a clerk, I would say. He did interpret, but he wasn't officially an interpreter the way that he was.
Let's talk a little bit about his career, because I'm sure that people listening maybe aren't as well versed as you both in his story. So this memoir is about the early part of his life, but maybe Jean, you can give us a sketch of his long life. What was, you know, his origins, and then where did he go throughout the 20th century? Because his life really spans 90%, I think, of the 20th century.
So what I know about Amadou Hampate Bass comes from, I would say, you know, the reading and research, and I'm sure Ralph also knows this very well. Part of what happens when you translate a book, though, is you become very intimately, you know it so well, you know, it's like somehow you know the person from the inside out, which is a very interesting feeling, although, of course, I've never met him. So I know what I've read from his writing and from the research. But as you said, as you introduced this, he became known later as the person who had said that famous saying, when an elder dies, a library burns, and it came in a speech that he had given to UNESCO. Once he had become a recognized collector of oral traditional tales and of other works from the oral tradition. And what I say in my introduction to the work is that I think he became more and more well known as he expresses in the two volumes of his memoirs, he worked for the colonial administration, but at a certain point he ran into trouble because of his religious beliefs and affiliations. And out of his friendship with Théodore Monod, Monod brought him to the IFON in Dakar, which was the Institut, at the time it was called Institut Français d'Afrique Noire. It was later changed to Institut Fondamental d'Afrique Noire. But once he began to work in that institute, he ended up working with some very well-known French anthropologists. And so his research into these oral traditions, especially Fula oral traditions, ended up being published and in a way co-published with some of the famous anthropologists of the time. And so I think that was the route to kind of his fame, as a scholar and ethnographer. And as Ralph had said, before he was working in the colonial administration, and he used the time working in the administration to also collect these oral traditions. So in the first volume of Umkulel covers not only his life, but it begins with his own prehistory, and that is the defeat of the Fula Empire of Messina by the Two Couleurs, and then the rise of the French colonial empire and administration in what they called the French Sudan at the time. And so the volume one goes from that time period, which precedes his life up until 1922. That's volume one. Volume two is called Oui, mon commandant. And that could be translated as at your service, commandant, or yes, commandant, which is the translator's dilemma, is how are you going to translate the, that is my project at the moment, is to translate the next volume. But that begins when he's 22 and has been sent off to work in Burkina Faso, which at the time was called Haute Volta, as a kind of punishment for not being as obedient as the colonial administrators would have liked. And so volume two is the story of his work in the colonial administration. I believe it ends in 1942, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct, Ralph?
Yep, more or less, yeah.
Yeah. So Ralph has also written an essay about his time in the section dedicated in the Oui, mon commandant book. Yeah. So he has a very deep analysis of sort of what's going on there. The relationship with colonial officials, what was going on behind the scenes. I'm sort of straying from what I meant to say, but.
Well, what I find, one thing that you brought up and which I find so remarkable in the kind of long span of his lifetime is he's born more or less around 1900, maybe give or take a year, and he dies in the early 1990s, I believe.
Right.
No, that's right.
And what he sees and what his life is in some ways subject to, these flicks of fate, as he calls them, is really the rise and fall of empires. The Two Couleurs Empire, the Empire of Messina, the French Empire, the collapse of the French Empire, a neo-colonial French Empire, American Empire. It's just kind of nested throughout his life. And I think it really contributes to his cosmopolitan ability to tell stories to everyone, to connect to everyone, because he's always kind of been in these moments of tremendous upheaval. Maybe Ralph, you can tell us a little bit about how he begins, you know, this volume of his memoirs in the this period of the late 19th century, and why he thinks it's important to introduce the reader to his own prehistory before arriving at his proper birth.
Well, I mean, the story he tells about his immediate ancestors is really fascinating, very complicated. It's not, I mean, he got this obviously from other people. He didn't, these are not things he witnessed, but it is presented as a kind of prequel to his own biography. And it's very complicated because in the conflict between these two empires, the Messina Empire was a jihadist state, that is a state that was founded by clergymen and one of its goals is to purify Islam. But it was then in turn overthrown by another cleric empire, Tukulu, and his parents were from both sides. He had membership in both sides, and he told these complicated stories about how his father, I think it's his father, was apprenticed, that was hiding with a butcher, I think it was, and then he's offered the chance to, you know, he's pardoned, he's under the authority of the other empire, the wrong empire, for his patrilineage, and then he gets, you know, he's offered the freedom, but he says no. His honor requires that he stay with this man who was his, you know, really functioned as his father. It's all very touching and very dramatic, and very well told. My suspicion is it's not entirely accurate because some of the events he describes later also turn out to be slightly embellished or dramatized, but they're good stories, and they are about, he knows the context he's talking about. He doesn't, you know, it's not like somebody, you know, from America or West Indies writing a historical novel, which has happened actually for this region. He is really telling from the inside, even if he makes all kinds of what we would call essentialist claims. Africans have infallible memories, and we're an oral culture, and we never forget anything, and so on, which is, you know, obviously not very plausible, and it turns out in closer inspection, his own writings display what you would expect to some extent, that there's some deviations. And especially the story of von Grand, which is who spent his whole life as a clerk. Well, the last part of his life, he was an entrepreneur in the private sector. And that's a marvelous story, trickster story, really, about a guy making his way, playing off the French, the politics and so on. You get some of the same thing in his memoirs about his own career, but it's much more dramatically presented in the von Grand book, which was successful in terms of the publishing history. That was published before, actually, even in France, it was published before the Amkulel. Amkulel may have been, actually, he may have been already deceased when it actually came out, I'm not sure. But certainly the second volume kept published, the Oui, mon commandant, was published after he died. But von Grand is something that he actually, von Grand is a real person. And he and his next to last wife was French. He usually had at some points in life the full complement of four wives for a Muslim. He was very interested in women. It makes it, you know, obvious. But this wife, the last one, she was a actually administrator. She kept his papers together. I actually got to see them after she died, but in an archive that she created. But she and he wrote a preface that insisting that everything about von Grand was true and so on and so forth. And, you know, just accept that almost as part of the narrative, that it's insistence on its own truth. It's not, I mean, with von Grand, I could really trace, you know, who he was, his career and so on. I've written a couple of articles about him. And But it still gives you fascinating insights into the possibilities, and also the thing about von Grand is it somehow follows some of the contours of a regional epic, especially with the role of secrecy and, you know, the vulnerability to secrecy and the way women are use their seductive powers to get the secrets from their mates on behalf of their actual kin. And so on, you have all of that in Van Grand. But it worked out really beautifully in a kind of French colonial context. But he wouldn't admit that. He would never say, well, this is a kind of a novel based on a real person. He insisted it was the story of a real person whom he actually had a relationship with. He was, they both of them were informants for a French folklorist who published a whole volume of stories and admits that these were his informants. So it's a very interesting mixture of his kind of imagining and recasting his life and the life of Van Grand in more literary, more dramatic terms. And yet you can learn a great deal about the actual social history of the French administration at its various levels, and the chief, since his father was a chief who was deposed and then were exiled and in prison and all that, which is, all, I assume, generally true, but the way he presents it, it just becomes extremely dramatic, and it's very, and very humorous. He's really has a great sense of humor. It's a really, some of the oui, mon commandant, the last line of the book, is, something really ridiculous is going on. The administrator has no idea what's actually happening and says what he thinks is going on, and Amiral says, oui, mon commandant. Leaves it at that. You can get his charm without having met him from these stories. He was a really charming, interesting guy. He had, he was also very involved in trying to become a certain kind of Muslim, and that's a whole complicated story which comes out. You don't see any of it in Amkulel, or very little. Mm-hmm. But in Oui, mon commandant, you get that too. He didn't have a standard Islamic education, because this is one of my favorite scenes also in the book. He's forcibly recruited into a French school because the person who's charged with recruiting them is an enemy of his family. And the worst thing he could do then is to be forced out of a Quranic school and could be sent to a French school. And he has this whole story about how he's being taken out and how the guy insults him. And then when he's dragged before the commandant who's responsible for this, sending these kids to school, he denounces the guy who recruited him and tells him all the things that he said against the French school, because the guy was trying, telling him you're going to have to drink pig's blood if you go to the French school, blah, blah. And of course, the French guy doesn't want to hear that. And it's not true, actually. I mean, this French, of course, already had laïcité in that period. These were schools run by the administration and by teachers who were probably Freemasons and so on, who were not the least bit interested in Catholicism or any other religion. And in fact, there's in Oui, mon commandant, there's actually a scene where he's in Burkina Faso and he has a battle with the local bishop, which is kind of interesting. It's a very rich set of writings and very engaging. Even though it's a big fat book, you can't put it down once you get into it.
Absolutely. He writes with an Italian, you would say scorrevole, it really flows. It's even though there's a lot of names and maybe things that if you're not from the region, you're not totally familiar with, you're immediately kind of plunged into the vivid storytelling that he has. I thought that Jean, you could recount to us, there's this anecdote, I suppose, that Théodore Monod, who was his kind of patron, I suppose, or mentor, who was a French anthropologist, historian, and really promoted his career. There's a story that he tells about Amadou Hampateba at the beginning as a preface to the memoir that I think really indicates the character and the talent of the storytelling and this building bridges that he had.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, so I think one of the things about Amadou Hampate Ba, I think that everyone knows about and something I wrote about in my introduction, is that he was constantly trying to, even though, as Ralph said, he had this sense of humor, and there are these really what I call a kind of polite hospitality in the books, and where he gives these jabs at the same time. So it's a very, within the body of the book, it's sort of, I don't want to fall into the, what do we call the essentialism of saying this is very African, but my theory is there's a kind of hospitality that welcomes you, the foreign reader, into the book. And then while you're reading it, someone's going to say, hey, look at that thing that somebody did, or those silly things that say the French did, and that they didn't even know what was going on, or see, this is why colonialism was bad, and here are the bad things that happened. But meanwhile, I'm going to keep telling this nice story, and I'm also going to give you the footnotes that tell you all about, you know, the culture, and I'm going to make this a very welcoming kind of environment for you, the reader, who's not necessarily always going to be an African. But I think that's part of what he was interested in as a person, which was bridge building, even though he has the critical kinds of barbs against, colonial figures or administrative figures or people that might have deserved having a little bit of mockery. But he also wrote a book which was called Jésus vu par un musulman, so Jesus seen from the point of view of a Muslim. And he was very interested as a Sufi Muslim in the kinds of relationships that could coexist between different religions, and the religions of the book. For example, between Islam, between Christianity, Judaism. And that's why I think Théodore Monod and he may have been friends. And that's what this reference is to. Somehow they decided that they were going to go talk about the question of love to members of a mosque. And it's not a very elaborate explanation. It's on page 6 in the preface. Here's the quote on page 5 from Monod himself. He says, as a devout Muslim, he would always seek to discover justification in his faith for the caprices of faith, of fate, I'm sorry. But let's see here. Yeah, so for example, I'm not here for the correct part here. But anyway, they went to visit a mosque, and the way in which Amadou Hampate Ba introduced the writings from a Christian saint was to kind of couch it in different terms. I think that's a sort of a more universal way of presenting the writings from St. Paul to members of a Muslim community. And so I think that's just, you know, an aspect of his constant efforts at bridge building that continued on throughout his life.
And Ralph, maybe you can talk to us a little bit about the title of this memoir, Amkulel, the Fula Boy, which evokes L'Enfant Noir as a title, the book by Kamara Lai from the 1950s. What is the title coming from in this book, and what do you think he might have been gesturing towards?
Well, I mean, the Amkulel part is, there was a man named Kulel who was a retainer in the court of their stepfather. His mother remarried, and she married a man who was a Tukulor prince, really, a high member of the royal family and so on, who had been a chief and then was deposed by the French, and they went into exile. And but he always had his father had a court in both a literal and sort of metaphorical sense. There were people who around him that he helped to support, and they also created a kind of culture, their own culture, even in urban colonial settings. And Kulel was part of this. He'd been a soldier in the previous regime, which suggests he was probably of servile origin, because that's how soldiers were largely recruited in these African empires. And Amkulel means little Kulel. So Habdeba apprenticed himself to what was essentially a slave, or sort of, you know, low retainer, but a man who had great talent as a storyteller. And he learned these stories, and he always remained quite devoted to Kulel. So that's the story. I mean, L'Enfant Noir, of course, is written quite literally for a French audience. There's a whole controversy about that book and that career that I don't want to get into here. But I've taught that book a lot. I mean, it does describe initiations and so on, which is very interesting, because one of the things that happens to Habdeba is he doesn't get properly initiated, never has a proper initiation. He actually goes at one point, because he's not even circumcised. And in a Muslim society, that makes you, infantilizes you, to say nothing of making you, that women will have nothing to do with you. And so he gets himself surgically circumcised by a French colonial doctor. But it's accepted by his family. They don't have a big celebration, or a fairly modest one, but it's accepted. But it's interesting that if this is supposed to be a coming of age story of an African child, missing the initiation, the whole elaboration of the initiation is a big gap, but he somehow manages to get around it and has no problem afterwards, other things, having many wives in the course of his life. And children. I knew one of his daughters, at least, of his last wife. That's the closest I became to meeting him. Whereas the L'Enfant Noir presents you kind of standard initiation. Who knows if it's literally, but it's generic. I mean, both of the books are written to some extent with the idea of a European audience and kind of educating them. They're written in French in both cases. And the idea is, among other things, is to present to the non-African French-speaking audience, and later also English-speaking audience in both cases, what African culture is like, that it really is a cultured society. And they both accomplish it, but in very different ways. I mean, Dark Child was written when the author was very young, and was living in France and exile. All of these are not, these are very typical kind of colonial experiences of intellectuals, and they're usually people of a certain generation who grew up after World War II, came of age after World War II, whereas Habdeba is a much earlier generation of African intellectuals who usually were much more mundane and sort of, didn't really find their voice as easily. He found the real voice that was, that expressed this kind of, what we now say, post-colonial theory, hybrid kind of identity or culture. And it's very successful. I mean, he's one of a kind. I mean, there's nobody of his generation who writes as well as he does. And essentially, he writes in French. He had people correct his French, but we can see from the Monod correspondence that has survived that his French was quite good, but he was very careful. And the only thing that he wrote in Fulbe, his native language, was religious poetry, which is another interesting thing. I've looked at it, but I can't do much with it. But some of it's been translated, and it's quite interesting. He was a really interesting. Person,
a real Renaissance man, if that term can be used. Someone polyvalent who worked and thought.
I wouldn't call him that because the range of things he was interested in were things that you would encounter in an African context. And he wasn't, for instance, he never really knew Arabic very well. So from a point of view of Muslim, he wasn't really well educated. His teacher, Cheno Bokar, who belonged to this offshoot of the Tijani Sufi order and himself was persecuted and died young as a result of that. And he himself, Hampe Ba, was, would have, his administrative career would have had stopped at some point for the same reason. But that the teaching of this guy was really not the standard, going from the Quran to all these other hadith texts and so on and commentaries. He really taught in a much more, in an oral fashion, wasn't really that much concerned with textuality. And he taught a lot of people who were not really very deeply involved in Islam. Bandiagara was not a fully Muslim city. The Dogon people are there. They are Muslim, but they're also very engaged in their local religious, their own traditional religious beliefs. And this fascinated Hampe de Ba, and they sort of write in some of his religious texts, which are not nearly as engaging, frankly, including the Jésus, Vu par un Musulman, which I actually wrote. The first thing I ever wrote about Hampe de Ba was about that book. It's not a profound, book, but it does show again the attempt. He was very ecumenical. He really tried to bring people together, and I think he succeeds best when he's less conscious about it. When he's writing these narratives, the three volumes of the memoirs, the third volume, which I've seen but hasn't been published or translated, isn't as good as the others because it gets much more involved in politics. And it goes back a step. It goes back into the 30s, even though, as you said, what you translated ends in the early 40s. But then he goes back in this book, in the other book, because there are all these quarrels among different groups and the Muslim groups and bringing in the French. And it's almost a kind of sordid politics, I haven't studied those very closely. At the moment, they're not really available for us.
Well, let's get back to this question, I suppose, of orality I think is at the center of his legacy and the complication of really, I think, kind of the transition of ways of transmitting and preserving knowledge that has happened throughout his lifetime, throughout the 20th century in West Africa. And Jean, you as the translator of this work really have to struggle with being at this interface of a text, but a text that's born of oral traditions and that is deeply aware of.
I wouldn't say the text is born of oral tradition, although he uses the word. I would say oral history. That is, of stories he hears from people about his own life, about the stories he hears about the 19th century. But they're not, they're not the distant past. They're very.
Right. So not the tradition, the oral tradition of Vansina, but the tradition of relaying knowledge in oral forms. Let me put it that way. So it's confusing. And that means, or that way of communication and of transmission. So Jean, you're faced with this quite long manuscript. How do you begin going about it? And what challenges do you encounter?
I found that the language of this book was, we were already talking about how well his writing flows, how well, what a great storyteller he is, how entertaining it is. So when I was translating this, in contradistinction to the book that I translated before this, which was not his book, it was a different book in a different style, which was much more difficult, I thought, because the previous book that I had translated used a lot of slang, and it jumped around quite a bit. It used a lot of allusions and things like that. This book, I think, has a kind of flow to it that I was able to, like I said, kind of immerse myself into the language of the text so deeply that I really, you know, you get this imaginary idea. And I think I said this in my introduction that the teaching from the Fula teaching that I repeated, I think, in my introduction, which was, you have to, if you want to, I'll just read it. And this was on page 29 of my introduction. And he said, my introduction says, he believed that in order for cross-cultural dialogue to take place, it was necessary to be able to listen to one another. But he also insisted that non-Africans would need to set aside preconceived notions about Africa, quote, in order to become pupils who know absolutely nothing, end quote. For A.H. Bhatt was the collected and as yet little known traditional knowledge of Africa that could help teach the future citizens of the world. To emphasize this point, he was fond of repeating the following admonition translated from the wise initiates of the African bush, which he called Labus, to those who would seek to discover their knowledge. And here's the quote. If you want me to teach you, you must stop being you to be me. Forget yourself in order to be me. Otherwise, if you keep being you, although we are face to face, we will be as distant from one another as the sky is from earth. This means that you must not take what I'm going to tell you and compare it to what you already know. You must empty yourself of what you know in order to learn. That is when you are told that you must know that you do not know. And then he quotes from Fulfulde, anda a anda. The full expression says, sa andi a anda a andat. If you know that you do not know, you will know. Sa anda a anda a andata. If you do not know that you do not know, you will not know. So I say this in my introduction. He says, stop being you to be me. Forget yourself in order to be me. So that was kind of, you know, you'd have to think it's very odd for a woman, a white woman from North America, would be somehow taking on this voice of Amadou Hampate Ba from Mali. I mean, that's what the magic part of translation is, I think. So I found it very enjoyable. The other thing that made it so enjoyable was a grant for a fellowship from the Camargo Foundation, which is located in the south of France, where they treat translators as artists who need time to work. I got a fellowship to stay there. I had my own apartment. All I had to do every day while I was there was translate. That was all I had to do. And there's no better way to go about, I think, working on something like this. So it was very enjoyable. That's all I can say about it.
Well, we're very grateful that you did that work, that you toiled day in and day out so that we can diffuse this this text more widely. I think as we come to a close here, I'd love to ask both of you what projects you're currently working on or upcoming projects. What do we have to look forward to? So Ralph, what are you working on?
I'm working on a very long book about colonialism, what's called The Road to Post-Coloniality. It's about the relationships between Europe and the larger world in tropical Africa, South Asia, and the French and British Caribbean. And I'm not sure I'll ever finish it, but I'm teaching a course on it right now. I think this is the last course I'll ever teach, and maybe then I'll concentrate more and actually finally finish this book. But that's my big project.
So at the super global scale. And Jean?
So I've started Oui, mon commandant, the translation of that book, and it's just as long as Amkulel. So I've had a very busy semester, so I haven't made as much progress on the project as I want, wanted to do, but I'll be leaving on May the 4th to go to France, and I'm going to be going to La Bibliothèque Nationale. I'll be going back to the Archives d'Outre-mer, I'm hoping to, you know, to have more time over the summer to really get into the flow of this next book, but that's what I'm working on at the moment.
So we'll have some more memoirs of Amadou Hampateba to look forward to, translated into English. Thank you both for your time today. Really enjoyed talking with you and paying tribute to this man. And I hope that we can speak about your future projects on the New Books Network soon.
Thank you so much for having us. Inshallah.